Mission number 12246, Lieutenant Colonel W. Waitman, Reel 11.
Colonel W.A. Waitman, Reel 11. Will you complete the episode you were describing on the last tape, Colonel?
Fine, Harry. Corporal Bobby Lowes had crawled back from the section. He was commanding his own section, but he brought back this wounded Private Smith who had been hit by a grenade thrown by Corporal Gardner. And through Smith being paralysed by fright, brought him back to my foxhole, and while we're talking in subdued voices, Shiner Harrison, my number one mortarman, popped up from the foxhole behind, and Smith suddenly shouted, "There's one," and jumped into my slit trench or foxhole and trampled all over Jeff Cooper, my runner, flung his arms around me and shouted, "Save me, sir, save me, save me, save me." And I flung him down into the foxhole between Cooper's sleeping body and myself. And I thought, God, you know, is there one? Forgetting all the time that Lowe's was on my left and House on my right. When I popped up, there was Harrison's shining face, so I was rather relieved at the time. And gave him a Smith, another jolly good shaking, said, "If you want to go back to the stretcher bearers, Corporal Cooper, that way, you can crawl back. And if you get shot on the way, that's it. But if you get there, he'll look after you. Because normally at night you didn't move under any circumstances whatsoever. Because all movement at night was hostile, and anyone in a foxhole or slit trench, if they saw any movement, they waited till that movement was right at the end of the foresight, and bang, that was it." But anyway, he made it, was evacuated, and then he rejoined the battalion, I think sometime several months later when we got to Rangoon and onwards, and Bobby Lowes went back to his own section, and Harrison went back to his mortar foxhole, and that was the end of the sort of difficult time that evening.
Soldiers that had lost their nerve in that way, were they always particularly difficult to spot and to deal with? Was it part of the officer's responsibility to look out for this kind of
situation? Absolutely right, Harry. And when I took over the platoon in the October of 1944, I was told who were the likely weak links, and then you spotted them as you went along, and you had to get rid of them whenever you could. Okay, a wound took over Smith, but he was always a weak link, and we go back to Izaguio when the medic officer, Captain Teddy Hubbard Jones, was going round the battalion checking on people, and he said to Private Husband, "How are you today, Husband?" And Husband said, "Well, I'm all right, sir, but there's so many people getting cushy jobs in the airstrip. I think I'll have a go myself." But Smith was always a weak link. He could have actually mown down the two Japs, but just paralysed with fear.
Did the men understand that kind of thing happening with amongst their comrades?
Was it something
they accepted?
Yes, and they resented them because they knew they were chicken. We didn't use that expression, which is, say, yellow or whatever. I think chicken came out as an American expression sometime during the war.
You mentioned, when describing several incidents on the other tapes, Colonel, the question of patrols, being on patrol. What exactly was patrolling like in Burma?
Well, it varied in strength from section strength to platoon strength, and from the position at Nut Kiang, where we were covering the brigade headquarters along with the brigade defence platoon, to Nut Nagatayor, where the battalion was, less our own company, C Company. I'd be told by the company commander, Tony Shuttle, right, Bill, just clear the track between the road and by road. It was a narrow motorable track, as it said on the map, to the village. Check and see if it's open. And I'd go down there and thought it was open. By that time the Japs had retired in the darkness and gone away. But we could see where they'd been by the footmarks, both the ordinary Jap army boot and the patrol boot, the tabby, the big toe and the rest of the feet in a sort of semi-elastic gym shoe type patrol boot. And I think the parachute regiment expression tabby comes from tabbing, comes from the tabby.
How big was a patrol likely to be? How many men?
Well, from a section of, say, 8 to 10 chaps to a platoon. By that time, I was down to about 2 dozen fellas. I finished up with 13 when we reached Mandalay.
The traditional picture of a patrol with the blackened faces and specialised weapons, was that true of your kind of experience?
No, we just set off, hale and hearty. And it was daylight, so there was no question of camping up. And we opened out, kept as open out as possible, and went slowly down the track between the motorable road and the village of Nagatayor.
Were there no patrols out at night, or did you stay in one place?
We didn't. Although the battalion put patrols out at night in the odd ambush, and Paul Rowlands, he certainly took one patrol ostensibly to go across the Irrawaddy River. That was from B Company in Nagatayor, and I think they went across in a dinghy type boat, but then drifted downstream and landed on the north bank. I don't know whether they ever reached the south bank, where the Japanese ostensibly were, and walking back the following morning, they bumped into some Royal Berkshires and heard us shout, "Japs!" And the Berkshires legged it, and I think Paul's patrol picked up the odd weapon that was dropped, and then walked to the direction of the Berkshires battalion position, and handed back what had been dropped, and then returned to our own 2DLI base at Nagatayor.
Were your patrols, your particular patrol, was that done in silence?
Yes, because he used very surreptitious hand signals, because as we'd found with Len Bedell at Parga a couple of months earlier, if you waved your hands around, obviously you're a commander or a leader of one sort and another, and you'll be the first to get taken out.
So there were certain signals which were recognised?
The normal hand signals. But by this time, you knew your formation, you were an arrow ahead or whatever it was, and you went along from sort of cover to cover, leapfrogging.
What are the virtues of Arrowhead?
Well, by Arrowhead, you've got traps in front, and then you were spread out left and right flank, and you could make a movement either left enveloping or right enveloping. It's one of the best formations going, Arrowhead.
In the actions that you'd seen up to now, what was the quality of support like that you were receiving?
Well, in the attack on Sandy Ridge, the Berkshires on our left had aircraft, Hurricanes, dropping 500-pound bombs and strafing. And we, in the attack that was on the left, on now Gwyn, but in our attack on Sandy Ridge, we had this troop of tanks who were absolutely superb and great support.
Could you communicate with the tanks?
Only by a telephone on the back. But as I said earlier, I have it on the side, and Peter Cornaby, the Squadron Second Command, opened up a side door, and I was able to ask him for close support on the ridge when we were wiggling out the last few Japs, or what we thought were the last few Japs. But obviously we missed the couple that came back after last light.
You mentioned once or twice Japanese who were not dead and who were then dispatched. Was there a rule that you didn't take prisoners, or you shouldn't take prisoners?
No, it was automatic, because we knew that Japs would try to take you with them, either with a grenade or some other form of self-immolation, but it was explosive, as we found with these 30... On Sandy Ridge, we later identified them as the 31st Division Engineers. You just could not take prisoners, because they would either kill you with whatever weapon they had at their disposal, a rifle, machine gun, grenade. So it was just automatic. It wasn't malice of forethought or anything like that, to use a legal expression. It was just automatic. You killed, and that was it. And our first prisoner was later on, after we crossed the Manley Rangoon Road. And to be precise, we captured 2 in 10 months and they were both wounded. And it was not... how shall we say, a matter of policy. It was just automatic. You just did it, because you knew if you didn't kill them, they would kill you. And there's nothing nasty about it. It was just SOP, Standard Operation Procedure.
You just had a rather severe fight and a lot of excitement. When everything calmed down, and you were able to kind of relax to a degree, what are the initial feelings after having gone through what you've just done, what you've just gone through?
Good point, Harry. Very, very thirsty indeed. And these Japanese engineers had dug into the ground 2 earthenware jars, what we call a chatty. Just as you have, you can carry it yourself or put it inside the vehicle, a chuggle, which is a cotton woven water carrier on the side of a vehicle, or carry it yourself in addition to your water bottle. They had these 2 chatties, earthenware jars, sunk into the ground, one of which had been shattered in the fighting. The other was intact, and we were gasping for water. We were keeping our own 1937 patent water bottles in reserve. But when we got on the objective and were digging in, my batman Armitage came up, Cyril Armitage came up with a woodbine tin, which he dipped into the intact chatty, full of cold water, and said, "Sir, have a drink." And that was like a bottle of champagne. And that helped both ourselves, C Company, and the left-hand position of D Company, to get some water into ourselves after sweating it out from first light in the morning when we moved off from the riverbank and into this two-battalion attack. Slow though it was, and at a walking pace and then latterly at a doubling pace, we were really in need of water by the late afternoon. And that water the Japanese had in that intact chatty was an absolute godsend. And even drinking out of a Woodbine cigarette tin was like, I suppose, a glass of champagne at Ascot.
Does fatigue come upon you after an exciting and stressful time like this?
It didn't then, because apart from the older members of the platoon, I was only 19. And I wouldn't say that I was ready for the powder hall sprint or anything like that. And I knew it. I'd done a hard old day's stint. But I wasn't shattered by any means. Although I knew I'd done a good day's work. And although we'd lost a couple of chaps, Leach, my colleague Kit Corners, Batman, from 11 to 2, and I'd lost Corporal Jennings, and then, okay, Corporal Wright out with deafened, and Private Charlie Husband wounded, I was still in pretty good fettle. And so were my lads.
Does stress or strain manifest itself at the end of an engagement?
To some extent. But we knew there was more to come, so we were ready for the next day, or, as it happened, we had a two-day break. But the following day, I was having got the chaps to pick bits of Japanese. A, the chap had been hit by the 75mm from the carbineer tank, and chaps had committed suicide, and chap had flung the box at me and got most of it himself. I said, right, go around, pick up the bits of flesh off these wild cherry bushes, and they were picking them off, and chap had been hit by the tank. I hooked a pick into his belt, dragged him into a hole and shoved a leg into the hole, went round burying him, all those bits and pieces. Later that morning I wanted to sleep, and I slept in my foxhole, and I dreamt I was in a hand-to-hand combat with a Jap, and I struck out with one arm vigorously and actually scraped my elbow on the side of the foxhole through reaction. And either that day or a few days later, Corporal Bobby Lowes told me that he had an awful dream, and said that in his dream Corporal Jennings came back and said he'd been buried alive. And I said, well, there's no question of that, he was stone dead. And I reminded him that he always snored and slept with his mouth open. He lay dead with his gob open.
What happened next, Colonel?
We waited on that position 2 days, and it was a very sobering thought to wake up either during the day when you're snatching a bit of rest, or the following morning for the 2 nights and mornings that we were there, and seeing these two graves about 10 or 15 yards away. But then we attacked the next village of Zalokma, and the division commander, General Nicholson, through Corps General Stopford and Army General Slim, put 4 Hurricane squadrons onto this village, bombing and strafing, and then 91 guns, or thereabouts. And C and D companies took it. Correction. A and B companies took it, and C and D companies then occupied it. And that was a tremendous attack. Two company, and for the loss of about one killed, 11 wounded, and 30-odd Japs killed, and two anti-tank guns knocked out, the battalion took the whole position. That was a very, very successful attack, I think, with minimum casualties, as only one killed. And the carbineers, the troop of tanks that supported the attack, went round the next village to brass it up and prevent Japanese reinforcement. And a Jap artillery officer climbed up on the bank, back of the leading lead tank, which was Peter Cornaby, the squadron second commander, who had been so helpful to me 2 days earlier on Sandy Ridge. And he was moving two up, himself left, sergeant right, corporal rear. The corporal couldn't get through to him because Peter was talking to squadron headquarters to warn him of this Jap. He didn't know who he was at the time, but a Jap was climbing at the back of the tank. And he stabbed Peter in the shoulder with his sword, which went right down to his thigh. And then he skewered the wireless operator, climbed inside the tank, and the gunner on the sponsor turret shot him with his revolver. Gave him 6 from his own revolver, and gave him another 6 from one of the dying men. And they pulled out of the action and trundled back to their squadron lager. And they have that sword in the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards, which is an amalgamation of the 3rd Dragoon Guards Carbineers, which are our tank support, and the Royal Scots Greys of Amazing Grace fame, their band. They have that sword in the Regiment Museum to this day. But that was 1st of March, or thereabouts, 1945.
Were the Japanese showing real signs of disintegrating at this stage?
They were certainly showing signs of disorganisation. They were trying to reinforce the south bank of the Irrawaddy for what their overall commander, General Kimura, called the Battle of the Irrawaddy Shore. But having General Slim having put 19th Indian Division onto the east bank of the Irrawaddy, north of Mandalay, and the 20th Indian Division southwest of Mandalay, and the 2nd Division in the middle, he then launched 4th Corps to cross the Irrawaddy further south of Pococu, and then head for Maktila, which was the main Japanese base and airfield base in central Burma, to secure those, to take out the Japanese there, and to remain there as the anvil. So 4th Corps was the anvil, and 33rd Corps, the 19th Indian Division, the 20th Division, the 2nd British Division, were the hammer. So his policy was the hammer and the anvil. And whilst that was happening, General Kimura, the Japanese commander, was pushing his chaps to defend the and try to thwart the Irrawaddy bridgeheads. But luckily we were able to hammer them, and eventually they were falling back as well.
What kind of distances were you going, and speeds you were travelling at this time?
I would think about 10 or 15 miles a day. But in the case of the slight leapfrog from Sandy Ridge to Lokma, about 1 mile. And then we pulled back into the bridgehead and had a short rest of a couple of days, and then broke out and went hell for leather for Mandalay, and actually to cut the Mandalay Rangoon Road, which I'll deal with in the next questions you ask.
How were supplies coming to you? Were they coming by road or air?
By air. Mainly parachuted in Dakotas. And behind us there were airstrips. And they'd either air land, bulldozed and disgorged the supplies, or dropped them in by parachute.
Were they adequate supplies, good supplies?
Oh, yes. Even mail, and my friend Corporal Beely, Military Medal, within the next 10 days, his supplies of Nestle's milk, which I'd given him this 30 rupees, or it was, to send, was coming through.
You mentioned that Corporal Beale had gone on leave. There were men actually being taken out on leave.
Yes, very, very few, the odd one or two here and there, going on leave to Calcutta.
Was the selection based on the amount of time they'd been fighting?
Exactly, yeah.
Or that the officer felt that they were ready for it?
Exactly the amount of time that they'd done. I didn't have anybody actually going out on leave, but Beagley came up to me in Hallador and said he was going on leave to Calcutta. Did I want anything? And I gave him the winnings from the Mule Gymkhana. And it was very well received, and I shared it with my chaps. And on the south bank of the Irrawaddy, I received two tins of cigarettes, one from a school teacher, I don't know, prep school, sent me a tin of, I think it was 50 cigarettes, and one from a girlfriend in Stanley County, Durham. And I didn't smoke, but I gave them to my soldiers. And I was always very, very grateful to that young lady from Stanley County, Durham, who sent that tin of 50 cigarettes, which my lads very, very much appreciated. And
how important were cigarettes to a soldier?
Well, they liked them because they smoked them. I personally didn't. I'd smoke, you know, 12 or 13 year old, whatever, school days. But smoking just didn't interest me. But I like to record how grateful I was to a school teacher from South Shields, Wallace Coxon, and his very attractive girlfriend, Margaret Louise Craven from Stanley, who sent this tin of cigarettes, which I appreciated very much because I learned to give them to my soldiers.
Were there rum rations given before an action? In the old Western Front style?
No. Occasionally, I can only remember rum coming up probably about twice. And I think it worked out something like a teaspoonful a man or something like that. But I didn't pay much attention to it. I wasn't a drinking man at that time. And I don't like rum to this day, so that how it came, I don't know whether it came by air or road or whatever, but it was insignificant.
Beer rations, when it arrived, were that important to the men?
The only time I remember beer arriving was at New Year's Day on the north bank of the Irrawaddy, just after that air attack, and we had something like a couple of bottles a man. I must say I drank mine, but it was during the day, and I found it very relaxing.
Were men's rations and officers' rations exactly the
same? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely identical. And they all always must be. And you had dehydrated potato, dehydrated onion, dehydrated carrot, dehydrated meat, mutton-type stuff. And you got biscuits, bacon, porridge, and everyone was the same, and quite rightly so. And we were very, very hungry indeed, and very, very thirsty. You had your 37 Platt water bottle, but it was a hardish time. A hardish time. But you had no option. And you got stuck in.
Was it difficult to keep men moving when they were hungry and thirsty?
No, because they were excellent. They were excellent. And we kept going forward, and we were out to cut the Madeleine Rangoon Road. But we just went from village to village. And I'll come to another action at Malagin on the 11th of March when we reach that, when we started to break out of the Inordinate Bridgehead, and describe that action.